Evening, everyone. Welcome to this session of In Depth. Can you all hear me clearly enough? Good. Good. Today we're looking at one of the more difficult topics to consider, and that is the question of suffering, and in particular the question of suffering and a good God. Christian theology maintains that there is a God who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving. Yet how do we square this with our experience and what we see in the world around us? Many of us will have suffered personally in a variety of different ways. We may have seen people very close to us suffering, and we may well have seen examples of suffering in the natural world, and undoubtedly on the television screens too. It's impossible to avoid the fact that we live in a world where there is a great deal of suffering going on. And this seems to raise a very big question for Christian belief. How do we reconcile that idea of God with the fact of suffering? There's a chap called Jules Renard who said, "I don't know if God exists, but it would be better for his reputation if he didn't." The question of suffering is a very serious question that has caused a loss of faith for quite a number of people. People in the church, people outside, people throughout history. Charles Darwin, one may think that he was challenged in his faith by evolution, by the discoveries he made in the scientific realm. Actually, it was the question of suffering. It was the suffering he saw in the natural world which made him question the existence of a loving God. It's a question that comes up a great deal in the Bible too. As we look at a book like the Book of Job, that book is entirely concerned with deconstructing various ideas about suffering. In particular, the idea that we can explain any particular example of suffering, or maybe that if we suffer, it's our own fault. There are ideas which are perhaps common in religious parlance that the Bible explicitly denies, in particular the idea that any example of suffering must be God's punishment on us, or that we can necessarily link some way in which we are suffering with something that we have done. What I want to do this evening is spend probably about 20 minutes looking at this question in some depth. I'll spend a little while thinking about the philosophy. Mainly, I'll be talking about the Christian response. And I'll try and point out some ways that we may be able to think of a good God in a world of suffering, and also some ways in which that belief can actually make a practical difference to us. I think, though, before I really get into the meat of it with the philosophy and the theology, I'd just like to lay out the ground, as it were. I'd like to mention some things I'd like to bear in mind. And the gist of these, really, is to look at the facts of a particular case of suffering. When we're talking about suffering, to try and take it away from the general picture, bring it down to something concrete. It's very difficult to deal with the generality. As an example, literature can make a very compelling argument, and there are some great novels and works of poetry which deal with the question of suffering. The Book of Job is one of them. Literature can be extremely persuasive and very compelling. I might take as a particular example Tessa d'Urberville's novel by Thomas Hardy. In it, the heroine Tess undergoes a series of horrible accidents, and every twist and turn of her life seems to be mocked by fate and haunted by a sense of providence that somehow turned against her. When she tries to do the right thing, it turns horribly wrong. And whenever she has a moral that she sticks by, it seems to rebound on her. And it's a deeply moving novel. In it, God seems to mock one who tries to live a good life, and the author rails against God. It's very moving. And then I stopped to think And I ask myself, well, who actually is this God? Well, it's none other than Hardy. Thomas Hardy created the story. He created the world that characters inhabit. Tess, Angel, their strengths and flaws. In a sense, then, it's Hardy who's to blame. And that, I think, is a problem with looking at suffering in the literary context, is that it can be... it's not rooted in a particular reality. An author has to make an example of something, and sometimes if that example is fictitious, it takes us out of a grounded reality. It takes us out of a situation where somebody may be experiencing not just the trials of life, but also the grace of God. So I think that if we are to put God in the dock, we must do so on the facts. I think another fallacy to avoid is the idea of the sum total of human suffering. I think one tends to get this looking at the news. Whenever I look at the news, it actually depresses me greatly sometimes. And when I'm on holiday, I have a break from the news. I actually find it's nice just to be in an isolated little pocket and not have the rest of the world to worry about. And that's lovely and peaceful. Because the news is a litany of disaster. And one can get weighed down by the great burden of that sort of suffering that there is in the world. People who may not be suffering in that way themselves can feel it. But I think it's important to point out that the idea of the sum total of human suffering, that's just a concept. Nobody ever feels that, except perhaps Christ on the cross. Again, I'm saying keep it concrete and keep it real. Likewise, maybe for animals, with Darwin, one of the big problems that he had was the parasitic wasps. And these are the little wasps that lay an egg inside a caterpillar and it sort of grows inside the caterpillar, eats its way through the caterpillar, and then finally bursts out. It's absolutely horrific. And Darwin had a real difficulty with this. It was one of the things for him that said, how can I believe in a God who created, in any sense, a world in which this happens? And that is a problem, isn't it? It is really unpleasant. Yet there is a danger, perhaps, of making it a bit too anthropomorphic, of putting ourselves in the caterpillar's situation. And whatever a caterpillar feels, it's not the same as what we do. So what I want to do when thinking about suffering is to say that we ought to listen to the people involved, to take seriously our own experience and our own testimony, both of the things that have been difficult and the points where the grace of God has been experienced. I think taking that experience seriously helps us to get a balanced perspective on it. And often I find that the philosophers, they like to talk in terms of the sum total of human suffering. They like to regard it almost as if it's a mathematical calculation. But it isn't. It's about individual people. It's about what individuals go through and what communities go through. And that experience that people have can work both ways. It is easy for us to look on the outside and imagine how it might be for us, but it may be very different on the inside for somebody who's actually having to deal with that. Just pause briefly. Has anybody got any comments on what I've said so far? Anybody want to come back to that or clarify anything? John.
You were arguing with that Thomas Hardy, because he wrote the novel, that he also created the God who was in that novel. But you could argue the same way, could you not, that Job, it also is literary, and therefore the person who wrote that also created his own version of God.
Yes, I think to a sense that's true, that when God appears in the book of Job, then that is the author's perception of God. And that is a perception that we'd want maybe to modify, perhaps in some ways, in the light of the New Testament. I think what I'm saying is that it struck me as an inconsistency with Hardy, that he's really angry against God. and yet it's actually him who's doing it to his characters. And he's sort of expressing his anger, and he's got a real anger underneath, which is against God. But that's because of a different situation maybe that's happened to him or something like that. Okay. We're moving on to philosophy. I don't find philosophy that satisfying, I must say. But I'm going to give a brief account of it, and I'm going to move on to what I find much more helpful. There are many different angles to a philosophical approach. One of the key ones is the idea that a good God must create a world where there is the greatest possible good. And what that's saying is that if God is going to be really good, then he's going to create a good world. And the world that God creates must be the best one possible, because if God didn't create the best possible world, then he wouldn't be a good God. So the philosophers are saying, well, God must create the best possible world that he can. But then they go on to say, well, the best possible world might involve the possibility of suffering. And there are two reasons for this. One of them is the reason of free will. The philosophers say that freedom is a good thing, that it's part of human nature to have the freedom to choose what is right and what is wrong. It's part of a good world to be able to choose our own destiny and to decide what we're going to do. So freedom is a good thing. Ability to make choices is essential in life. And those choices may be good or they may be bad. And then the philosophers say, well, if we've got that ability to make choices, and choices are a good thing, then if those choices are going to be real, then they have to have genuine results. In other words, if I decide to hit somebody over the head with a churchwarden's stave, then that is something that must be allowed to happen, because it's a decision that I've made. It has consequences. If there were a world where I made a bad decision and God were to intervene to stop me from doing anything bad, then I wouldn't actually have free will, would I? And that's essentially what the philosophers are arguing about free will, that it needs to have consequences to be real and genuine. So theft, for instance, if someone decides to steal, then the world that they live in must allow that to happen. And the philosophers actually use this as well to explain all sorts of forms of suffering, like we know, for instance, that some cancers are the result of things that we do. There's a well-established link between smoking and lung cancer, for instance. And so they put all kinds of things down to freedom and free will. Philosophy says, therefore, that free will needs the possibility of good and bad. It needs the possibility of suffering that implies, and that if you're going to have free will, which is a good thing, then you must have a world where that is allowed to happen. And so the philosophers say, if God's going to create the best possible world, then it's a world where there may be that possibility of suffering. They're saying that God is good, and God gives us freedom. A slightly different angle on that, but it's essentially a similar kind of argument, is Irenaeus and the veil of soul-making. One of the early Christian writers, described soul life as a kind of valley through which you passed, and it was the making of you. It's a bit like going to one of those tough boarding schools where you have to have cold baths at 7 in the morning, go for a run around the field, and all the rest of it. And it sorts you out, it makes you good, supposedly. And Irenaeus is saying, well, can virtues exist without danger? Can there be good without it ever being tested? And there's a fair point in that, isn't there? I mean, what does courage mean if I stand here and say that I am a courageous person and I could stand up for what I believe in? Well, we only find out whether I'm truly courageous when I'm put in a situation of physical danger where I have to stand by what I believe. So another philosophical argument is that in order for good things like virtues to be demonstrated and proven and tested, there needs to be challenge and danger and risk. One might also bring in the scientific insight that a world which is set up the way that it is seems to imply a certain amount of risk just in the way that things evolve. So that's philosophy. And I think the gist of that, I say that's philosophy, yes. You do whole degree courses in philosophy, can't you? And I've summed it up in 5 minutes. Not in the slightest, but just a little insight, perhaps, as far as I can understand it anyway, and I haven't done a great deal of philosophy. But the gist of the argument there is that it's all about the best possible world and how that might necessitate risk and danger. Anybody want to come back on that so far? No? Sorry, the two?
Two parts of free will, you know, the good and the bad.
Yes.
Yes? Which seems to be an ongoing battle.
Yes, it is, absolutely. And I think that's the point that they're trying to say. It's an ongoing battle. We have to keep striving with it. And if we lived in a world that was perfect in the sense that nothing bad could ever happen, then it wouldn't actually be a perfect world, they're saying, because we wouldn't be truly free. Whether you buy that argument or not, I don't know. For me, as a Christian, I think discussing this from a philosophical point of view is like wrestling with one arm tied behind your back, because the unique insights that Christianity brings, for me, are the things which convince me that God is good and that faith in God has something to say to a world of suffering. I find the philosophical approach is just so abstract, it's so up in the air, it's kind of like adding up numbers on a calculator. And, you know, you kind of weigh up free will and you weigh it up against the risk of it, and you might decide, well, it's worth it or maybe it isn't. It just seems so kind of abstract and doesn't really connect to the experience that we go through. And I don't personally find it a great deal of help, but that's philosophy. So, on to the Christian perspectives. Christian faith is always about the way that we respond and the way that we act. And when we're reading the Bible, we tend to find that the explanations of why something is the way that it is come a rather distant second to what we do about it. For me, though, the response is actually part of the answer. And I think finding the response to suffering is more effective in reality than perhaps having an abstract and conceptual idea of why it happens. One of the big arguments that the Bible puts forward, and one that's quite challenging, is that idea of sin. The responsibility of humanity in choosing wrong. I've talked about free will, and the idea of sin is really an extension of that. And when we think about it, there does seem to be a great deal in this world that's accounted for by that. When you think of all the space of knife crime that we have going on at the moment. Now that, to me, doesn't seem to be anything that God does to us. It's a world that we live in where human beings do these things to one another. And it's something in humanity and something that is a failing in human beings rather than something that God has made. It's the fact that we turn away from God's way and do the wrong thing rather than the fact that God has set up the world like this. But is this a cop-out? Is it letting God off the hook? I mean, it accounts for lots of things, doesn't it? It accounts sin, not living righteously, disobeying God, even mere carelessness. It accounts for murders, wars, thefts, a great deal of the famine that we see in the world. Just think how many of those are due to misrule, like Zimbabwe, or the poor distribution of goods, like the Bengal famine of many decades ago, or the way the market is twisted, or the inequitable distribution of resources, or the deforestation of land. There's so many things which maybe at one level appear natural, but actually when you trace them back, they come back to human greed or a lack of goodness to one another. Well, what about natural disasters? That's God's realm, surely. Yes. And yet even there are effects which are all too human. There was an earthquake in Pakistan a couple of years ago, and we heard a great deal about it, about all the people who died. And there was a similar earthquake at a similar time, very similar level on the Richter scale. Very few people died. Anyone know the difference? Due to the buildings. In Pakistan, the buildings had been badly built. They hadn't stuck to regulations. There was corruption in the building trade. When the earthquake came, the buildings fell. And it's not earthquakes that kill people. It's the buildings that they're in, collapsing. We take even the tsunami. People died on the east coast of Africa hours and hours after the first tsunami reports came in, because nobody had told them. And it's tragic things like that which make the impact of global disasters quite so bad. I don't think you can put all suffering down to us, down to humanity. I think it does raise, though, a very big question. And it raises a question to force us to look at ourselves, to force us to look at the world and what people do in it, and to change. C.S. Lewis describes suffering as God's megaphone, where it calls us back, waking us up to a reality that something is wrong. Moving on from there. Very soon in the Bible, after we hear the story of Adam and Eve, we then move to the fall. And as part of the story of the fall, where they eat the forbidden fruit and are thrown out of the garden, there are various curses which are pronounced on humanity. And amongst them, God says childbirth will be difficult, that the land will not yield its crops without hard work, and that suffering will be part of life. And there's this idea that the world is not quite the same again, that when humanity sinned, it somehow changed the fabric of existence. This, I find, a very difficult argument to reconcile with science. Because if you look in the fossil record, for instance, you find examples of dinosaur bones which show clear evidence of disease. If you accept the theory of evolution for how life has progressed, then evolution demands that animals eat each other, that there's competition, that there's nature red in tooth and claw. Evolution doesn't work without that. So it seems very difficult to say that the world as we know it changed somehow, that God made it this paradise, and then it somehow changed with Adam and Eve, and it's never been quite the same since. It's very difficult to try and bring those together, unless perhaps you believe that there is a special situation for human beings. I think, personally, that the most we can say about that biblical insight is it tells us that the world is perhaps not the way that God intended it. And that does raise questions about that philosophical approach, the best possible world. As if God made the best possible world and then something went wrong, and presumably it isn't the best possible world anymore. And a couple of bits of background. Now, looking to how we deal with it. There's one thing for me which completely changes my perspective on suffering. There's one thing which takes all the abstract out of it and makes it something which is concrete, which enables me to have faith in God and trust in him. And that one thing is the cross of Christ. Because What Christian theology says about the cross is it says that God humbled himself and shared in human existence. It says that God shared in our lives, that he experienced suffering for himself, that Jesus went through what it was to be human at that time and endured it. And that, for me, completely changes my attitude towards God. Because God is not this kind of far-off, distant person who set up this world that we all live in without it having any consequences for him. The cross says that God has entered into this world and shared it. There's a story that's told all about the Last Judgment, and the people are all waiting there, ready for God to come and for the judgment to begin. And as they're waiting, there begins to be a bit of a grumble and a bit of a murmuring. What right has God to judge us? What right has he to stand in judgment? What does he know? And someone, a beggar, stands up and says, what does God know about being poor? Let him first be born as a poor man. And then a survivor of a concentration camp stands up and says, what does God know? Let him first be born as a member of an oppressed minority. And then somebody else stands up and says, I was executed unjustly. Let God go through that. And so on. And they've drawn up this great list of things that God must do. Poor, minority, earn a living, die young, experience all that life has to throw at you, be bereaved, suffer an unjust death. And then there's a silence in heaven because they realize that God has done that. And for me, it just changes the way that I look at suffering because God has been there, he knows what it's like, and he draws alongside us. Suffering also is changed by the cross because the cross says that God has redeemed it. On the cross, Jesus bears the sin and the pain of the world. He atones for it. He takes the world's iniquities, he takes the world's diseases upon himself, and he atones for them. He suffers the punishment that is due to humanity so that we can be forgiven. And so the cross also tells us that the problem of suffering is a problem that God is acting on, that God does not leave us in the lurch, that he comes to share it, to take it upon himself, and thereby to open the way to its healing. It doesn't explain why, but it does tell us that God is with us and that God is opening up the way to a cure. So then on to the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 3, verses 14 to 16, the writer says, he's talking about Jesus here. If anyone wants to follow us, it's page 217. It's Hebrews 3, 14 and 16. He says, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. So he's thinking about the death of Jesus and the fact he returns to God. Let us hold fast to our confession. Let us hold firm to our faith. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who in every respect has been tested, as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore approach the throne of grace with boldness, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. He's saying that Jesus, because he became human, he identifies with us, and that he knows what life is like, and because of that, he can give us strength. It's like he's somebody who's hacked the way through a jungle so that we can follow, or like when you're receiving comfort for somebody, that is so different when they've actually been through the particular experience that you're going through, and they can draw alongside you. And the writer of the Hebrews is saying, Jesus can do that. And in reality, my own feeling about suffering is that when you're going through it, that seems to be the most important thing, knowing that God's there. It's a knowledge of God's presence with me, the knowledge that people are praying and supporting. That means so much more than theoretical questions and answers. After Jonathan was born, the thing that really made a difference to me, it wasn't the free will defense or anything like that. It was things like homemade lasagna and people bringing Peter down to the hospital to baptize Jonathan. It's that kind of thing. The practical help. And so, for us, God's help, God's strength through his Spirit, God's help through other people, that, I suspect, is how God ministers to us. And it may be perhaps how we can help other people who are struggling with this question. It's the practical answers. And then finally, heaven. Heaven has been much divided as the kind of goal of religion and the opiate of the masses, pie in the sky, something to look forward to when you die and not much use on earth. Now, certainly, we mustn't focus on heaven to the detriment of working for better society on earth. But that biblical doctrine of the new earth and the new heaven is something that follows on logically from the cross, that God will make a new world. It's the completion of God's plan. And I think it is a great source of hope. As it says to us, this isn't the end, but there is something better, a future with God, and a perfect world, and a healing for all creation. So to sum up the biblical picture, what we have is not really a philosophical discussion. What we have is an account of a historical way of looking at it. It says that God made a world that was good, that human actions have spoilt it, through what we do to one another and in some way affected the world, but God has entered into it and given us a salvation and a deliverance from suffering and has given us strength to bear it through his Spirit and through the help of one another. And he holds out to us the promise of a full healing, ultimately. So the Bible gives us a picture of a journey that we're on that leads to the resolution and the end to suffering. What is a Christian response then? I think it's understanding humanity's part in it and working for a better world, passion and commitment. It's knowing that God suffered for us and strengthens and lives with us today. It's accepting also the promise that one day God will bring healing and allowing that to bring hope to us. I'm aware that that may not have quite answered the question of why is there suffering. To me, though, I think it does help me to understand how there can be suffering and there can be a God who is good. Shall we move to questions and reflections?